This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we talk about politics, our favorite thing, every week, Brandon.
One-stop shopping right here.
I know. And, you know, every week we tell you ourselves we're not going to have a lot to talk about.
Right.
They're going to give us a week off, but lo and behold, it continues and continues.
This was just a big week, even by, like, usual standards.
There's a lot going on. And so just off the top, did you know that the President of the United States can pardon himself, Brandon?
Right. Physician, heal thyself.
Exactly.
President, pardon thyself, right? Yeah, the President and the President's attorneys apparently submitted a letter which suggests that the President cannot illegally obstruct any aspect of the investigation, because essentially the Constitution empowers him to, if he wished, terminate the inquiry and even exercise a pardon power. The President tweeted that he has the absolute right to pardon himself. But why would he when he's done nothing wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Apparently the President has not made it out to Hamilton and recognized that we had this thing called the American Revolution not too long ago.
Yeah.
And we don't have a king.
That was like last week, right?
Yeah, exactly. We don't have a king. We have a president. No one's above the law. Even Richard Nixon used that exact phrase. No one's above the law. The mechanism to deal with the president, of course, is the impeachment process.
Right.
So if the president attempted, I think Rudy Giuliani even said this, to preemptively pardon himself, it would almost likely trigger impeachment.
Yeah.
It's a silly thing to say, and I think Ted Cruz probably said it best when he paused for 18 seconds without actually saying anything.
Right, right. And he said he would study it. I think those who have studied it have suggested that the president, generally speaking, there's no law that says that the president can't do this, right? It's not in the Constitution. The pardon power itself has some limits, one of which is that you can't pardon somebody for something they haven't been convicted of. So, I mean, the president is in some ways right. The fact that he hasn't been convicted of anything means he can't be pardoned. But can he pardon himself? I just think it's really unlikely that any court would suggest that, given the structure of the Constitution and given how the framers intended it all to be working in this perfect balance, that they would allow a president to pardon himself for these kinds of crimes.
So we don't know, right? Yeah, well, the problem is the mechanism for a president is to be impeached,
right,
and then you have a trial in the Senate. If that were to happen, he's no longer president of the United States,
right,
and can, by action of law, cannot pardon himself. So this is sort of weird circular argument. It's a dumb thing for them to say.
Yeah. Bad political move. Right.
But it takes away from conversations about other things, like the fact that Paul Manafort, the president's former campaign manager, may be spending the rest of his time in jail for violating his bail agreement because he was trying to tamper with witnesses, Brandon.
Wow. Yes, he apparently did this through an intermediary who had worked through this app called WhatsApp. With the hope that he would basically try to coordinate some kind of a response to some of the questions that the special counsel was asking. When I first saw that it was the What's Up app, I thought, what's up? Well, witness tampering is up. This is not a good move for Manafort and definitely drags on this process, which is, I think, ultimately, of course, leading back to the White House.
Well, speaking of leading back to the White House, we also have an ongoing issue with the EPA Director Scott Pruitt. He continues to be in hot water. He's already had allegations of sort of financial misdeeds in terms of how he's, what he's spending his money on and how he's spending it. Now he's in sort of a little mini mattress gate, shall we call it?
Mattress gate. Yeah, apparently he is under investigation by 17 different individual offices or institutions. The emails this week revealed that he spent about $3,000 on a custom silver fountain pen and journals for his office. He also had, in line of your mattress gate response, instructed an aide to apparently seek a used mattress from the Trump hotel.
My question is, why used?
Why used?
And does he not realize that you can just...
the hotel.
Exactly. And does he not realize they sell mattresses on Amazon?
Right.
This is like, you know, point and click kind of situation. Why is he even doing this?
He also asked, apparently, aides to do things like find his wife an opportunity to franchise a Chick-fil-A. I mean, everybody loves Chick-fil-A, but let's do this the right way. Why does it matter? Well, I think partly it matters because in some ways it's a smokescreen for all the kinds of actions that he's taken as EPA director, right? A lot of which have been very controversial. but it also just another kind of, you know, drip, drip, drip for scandals in the Trump White House.
Yeah, I think the issue on using your public office to attempt some sort of private remuneration in the form of a Chick-fil-A franchise, which we know is basically a license to print money, since no one can resist the Chick-fil-A nugget.
No, it is basically like, yeah, hand over fist money, right? Yeah. And then you can buy a mattress instead of having to get a used one, right?
Right. Well, the president has also found himself in his ongoing battle with the NFL. Mm. He's got this issue now. He basically told the Philadelphia Eagles, the reigning Super Bowl champions, don't come to the White House.
Yeah, thanks, no thanks, right? I mean, I wouldn't want the Eagles anywhere near me either, but that's a different problem.
Well, that's because you know, you're a reformed Cowboy fan.
Right, right. But this is an ongoing battle between the president and the NFL. The last week, the NFL came out with rules that suggest that if you don't want to stand for the national anthem, that you should just stay in the locker room. And the president basically backed this, saying like that you should be more patriotic. In lieu of having this ceremony, the president had a big kind of pomp and circumstance event at the White House. You know, many Sousa tune was played and, you know, many flag was waved to sort of demonstrate.
And apparently that God Bless America was sort of lip sync, at least for the first two bars, to which the president seemed to not know the rest of the words.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, he needs to have it like on a little card like he did when he was comforting victims for Harvey, right? Like, that would be helpful. Some good staff work there is critical. But I think that this is, again, a kind of cultural issue for the president, right? To be honest, it's a winnable issue for him, right? This is the kind of thing that really separates those people who are kind of his core supporters from people who believe that there's kind of a bigger right here just to protest the way that the U.S. is handling various things. So this is not uncommon, and it's something, frankly, he can win on politically.
Yeah, it's always politics for him. And I think in that sense, it seems counterintuitive to us because sports is supposed to sort of unify the country. But the president, I think, is looking at it entirely from a political framework.
Yeah. And that's these are not political issues, right?
Right.
I mean, it's not a political thing, but now it is.
Yeah, exactly. He's sort of using it to his advantage. But on the same vein of sort of politics, since we're talking about the midterm elections around the corner, California primaries just happened this past Tuesday. What happened there?
Yeah, so, I mean, a couple of worries for the Democrats were that they'd get shut out of this kind of unusual jungle primary that the Californians run. So basically, top two vote getters get to go to the ballot in November. The fear was that there were so many Democrats running that the Democrats wouldn't be able to get a Democrat on the ballot. That didn't actually happen, right? It turns out, in fact, that there are Democrats running in all these races, especially the important ones like Senate and governor. Down ballot, they also were able to do well and at least get a Democrat in the races where they think they can pick up seats. The good news, though, then, is it didn't hurt them. The bad news is that the cumulative vote percentages for Democrats in several of these places, in several of these counties or districts where Clinton did better, the Democrats collectively didn't do that much better than they did otherwise. One race that was very highly watched, or this is actually a place where I used to work, California 48, Dana Rohrabacher, who is vulnerable as any Republican across the country, who's been close to Trump, he's been sort of, you know, very close to Russia. He got basically 51% if you include all of the Republicans together. He only got 30% himself, but it suggests that maybe it's the case Democrats aren't as likely to be able to pull out wins in places like California as they thought they would. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think they had thought they had a real shot at sort of running the table in the seven districts that Republicans held that Clinton had won. It's increasingly looking like they may not pull all seven, maybe three to four folks. Someone like Dana Rohrabacher may actually be able to hold on.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens. That magic number they need of 24 wins nationally, they may struggle to get there, and it's going to be close. Mm-hmm. They'll certainly make gains, but that generic ballot, I think, is not nearly as strong for Democrats as we once thought. Well, shifting gears a bit, Brandon, let's talk a little bit Texas here. We got a lot going on in the Lone Star State. Our esteemed land commissioner, George P. Bush, what's going on with the doctored report?
Yeah, so before the primaries, the land commissioner and his aides dismissed this report that was leaked. The report essentially said that the Alamo was being mismanaged in all kinds of different ways. The administration of George P. Bush basically said that they wouldn't disclose why, but that they had evidence that the memo was doctored. Okay, well, the fact that the Alamo is like one of the most iconic things that Texas has and one of the most important things the land commissioner does was a major issue in his primary. It turns out that the actual final report was pretty close to what the leaked report looked like, suggesting that there were serious budgeting issues, expenditure and contracting problems with the Alamo that needed to be strengthened. So it turns out the report was pretty close on. Is this going to hurt him politically?
Probably not, because I think people have sort of forgotten. I think we need to remember the Alamo.
They've forgotten the Alamo.
I think they certainly have forgotten that he, in fact, you know, threw out the whole fake news item back in the day. But yeah, I mean, look, George P. Bush, I think, took a page out of Donald Trump. You basically discredit something, even when you know it's true, and you're counting on people to forget. He probably won't suffer too much blowback. I don't know how this affects him long term. But I mean, I think the symbolism of this, I think, is tremendous because it is the Alamo.
You know, it's my contention, and I've said this a bunch of times, like, good governance doesn't get a fair shake in Texas, right? And we've had this back and forth when it comes to the governor and some of the state agencies. I don't think it's that impactful for most Texans, and frankly, partly because people aren't paying that much attention to these offices, which they don't know that much about.
Well, one of the things they're not paying much attention to is the fact that Texas has, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, has been leading the country in removing Confederate symbols. We know all across the South, there's been this issue of removing sort of vestiges of honorific titles and monuments to the Confederacy. Texas, surprisingly, has been leading the way.
Yeah, this is interesting. The one place they're not leading the way is in and around the Capitol, and that's been a serious point of contention. My guess is there's going to be some effort to try to remove at least a few of these, but it's politically hot. And so I don't know that it's going to get much traction, especially when we're going to see a lot of pretty controversial issues on the agenda in the 86th session.
Well, if there's an unwritten rule in politics, Brandon, is you never attack a candidate's mom.
We're going to have a mama off here.
We get a mama off here. I know.
That happened fast.
Senator Ted Cruz took a page out of Donald Trump, who famously attacked his wife and attacked his father, and decided to go after Beto O'Rourke's mother. What happened?
Yeah, so Cruz apparently called O'Rourke a hypocrite for supporting business taxes, sales taxes for businesses for sales across state lines, pointing to a furniture store owned by O'Rourke's mother, who was found guilty in 2010 of tax law violations. This is an unusual attack, I think, Jay, for a couple reasons. First of all, it suggests perhaps a strategy from the Cruz campaign that is either one that wants to go for a knockout blow or one which suggests that they're really worried and are using this kind of earlier than I think one would expect. But to me, for the O'Rourke campaign, the kind of response of, we're not going to respond to this, right? This is beneath us. This is not important for people, is only going to keep you above water for so long. If you're treading water for 6 months on these kinds of attacks, then you are not going to be able to move the needle. And he needs to be able to make some inroads with voters. And this is not the way to do it.
No, I agree. Look, Ted Cruz is a really unpopular guy. People do not like him. Beto O'Rourke, if you know him, is considered very likable. I know he wants to be the nice guy in this, but he's going to have to punch Ted Cruz in the face verbally.
Yes.
Otherwise, there's not going to be much movement here. Brandon, last week the governor came out with his school safety, his gun plan. What's been the fallout from it? What's been the reaction?
There's been some pretty serious pushback, actually, from some of the more conservative groups saying that basically this is the governor's way of limiting people's gun rights. But there's been some pushback on that even. Jerry Patterson, the former land commissioner, came out and said that this is not an attack on the Second Amendment. This is something which is reasonable and helps to protect kids. So this is going to be a pretty big issue. I mean, we're definitely going to see it come back. But the fact that there has been pushback from Republicans may be a factor in Greg Abbott not calling a special session, which he said he would only do if there was consensus on that issue.
Yeah, I think it just sort of reinforces in his mind that there is no consensus, but he's then laid the table. But I also think, again, we've talked about this in the past, this artificially presents the governor as somehow trying to bridge the divide that exists in the state on this issue and making him appear more moderate than I think he actually is.
Yeah. Well, Jay Summers here, and we turn to basketball and the NBA playoffs. Sadly, our Rockets didn't make it, but there's another playoff in town. What's going on with that? Political playoff, as it were.
Yeah, Ted Cruz and Jimmy Kimmel going one-on-one. I know it's absurd, isn't it? Well, as you know, Jimmy Kimmel was heavily critical of Ted Cruz in the past and made fun of Cruz, you know, talking about basketball when he was campaigning in Indiana and, you know, sort of botched calling it a ring instead of the basket. And he's challenged him to a one-on-one tournament because of Ted Cruz famously tweeted out during the Rockets game and people are calling him a jinx. And so now they're going to actually do it.
That's funny. Yeah. I hope that Ted Cruz is a better basketball player here than he is at labeling things on the basketball court. I'm going to go with Jimmy Kimmel on this one. I think in terms of being in shape, I think Kimmel's probably a bit better. But this shows an impish side to Ted Cruz that is, I think, endearing for some, but definitely could go too far here. So we'll see how this plays out.
You know, if he can make fun of himself regardless, yeah. I think it's a positive thing for Cruz. Yeah. I think he's more effective when he tries to do that. Yeah. It takes away some of that kind of negative feelings of people. Yeah,
like
the edge
said,
that
he's
people have.
Not well liked, partly because people perceive him to be kind of too remote, but this is a way of endearing himself to people.
Well, Brandon, you know what's really not endearing some people right now is the comments made by the president related to what happened here with Hurricane Harvey and how Houstonians reacted to having to civilians going out there to rescuing people who were trapped. The president made light of it, essentially seeming to argue that people were out on their boats trying to watch the hurricane come in.
Yeah, like it's fireworks or something.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Insulted a lot of people that were trapped and a lot of people that were essentially rescued and saved lives.
Yeah. I don't know what the president is talking about here or what he's doing here. There's no upside to saying people were out watching the hurricane. That doesn't make any sense in any case. So I'm not sure if it's bad staff work or if he's just misinformed or what, but the fact is this is not true, right? People were legitimately out there helping. The Cajun Navy had come to the rescue of so many Texans, and we are appreciative of it. And I don't know why the president would even broach this, because it doesn't help him at all in any way.
Yeah, I think the thing that caught my eye was the fact that both Greg Abbott, Dan Patrick, Ted Cruz, none of them wanted to essentially push back on the president on this. They all seemed to act and avoid the situation, which again goes back to sort of the larger politics of criticizing the president doesn't always work to your benefit. And so they decided not to say anything.
They embrace sometimes, right, when it politically benefits them, but other times they'll just distance themselves or say nothing like this.
Well, speaking of Harvey, the other end of it, we know that the damage that occurred, a lot of students were not able to attend school. Yep. It created all sorts of issues. The Texas Education Agency has come out with a set of rules on what they're calling Harvey waivers. Mm-hmm. If a school was out for 10 days, 10 instructional days, that school would not be subject to accountability ratings, and so that their scores for the year would essentially be null and void. This would give schools kind of an extra year kind of to be able to reset. The big implication in the Houston area in HISD is that it may potentially lead to either the imposition of a board of managers or school closures, because four of those schools aren't eligible for a Harvey waiver.
Mm-hmm. This seems somewhat fair to me, right? I mean, the HISD situation is, you know, predates these kinds of rules, but it seems to me that some kind of a waiver here is really important. I mean, you're an expert on this. What's your call?
Yeah, look, I think the waiver is important. I think for these four schools, many of them they've been chronically underperforming for a very long time. I don't know if the commissioner is going to have any flexibility. These rules are made for a comment period.
Yeah.
They may or may not change, but I think at the end of the day, we need to, the community as a whole probably needs to prepare for the possibility of a board of managers coming in. So we'll wait and see.
Well, speaking of boards, hey, we've got an interesting ruling from the Supreme Court. Why don't we take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about that. So, Jay, the Supreme Court had a big week this week, right? We're at the end of the term, and we expected fireworks, and we got it, right, in the form of a wedding cake. Explain.
Yeah, sure. This was a longstanding case coming out of Lakewood, Colorado, and it dealt with an issue of whether or not a baker in Lakewood was asked to bake a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. Mm-hmm. He refused, citing a personal religious objection to it. Now, the issue is Colorado, the state of Colorado, has a non-discrimination ordinance, mm-hmm. which essentially sort of comports with the idea that you can't discriminate based on a series of categories, of which sexual orientation being part of. He essentially asserted, the baker in this case, that it was a violation of his freedom of religion, mm-hmm. freedom of religious expression, to being forced to do it. The court heard it, and I think there's some interesting things back and forth, but it was a really focused, limited ruling,
yes.
essentially arguing that procedurally there were violations that took place early on under this Colorado system. It was not a larger ruling, so kind of both sides are claiming victory. Both sides are kind of claiming defeat,
right.
But at the bottom line is this was a relatively focused response by the court only to this case, and doesn't have any further appealing in terms of religious objections to this order.
That was my reading, too, that, you know, Justice Kennedy's decision in the 7-2 decision too, which is not like a close one, right? The 7-2 suggests that there's a fairly high degree of unanimity around Kennedy's decision, which was fairly narrow. And that was basically that. In this case, the commission, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission, had not adequately allowed for there to be religious beliefs taken into account. So basically that it was okay that this occur because that balance had to be met. The ruling itself, I think, was important because the question is whether or not this will unleash a kind of flood of other kinds of cases or other kinds of legislation that will allow for religious refusal or religious protections to be able to expanded. The ruling held, and I quote from Kennedy's decision, that the right to free exercise of religion can be occurred if it is in a but it is limited by generally applicable laws. So in effect, this is allowable only if it doesn't conflict with other kinds of laws. So what's your take on kind of the bigger implications to the ruling here as it relates to the rest of the country or to Texas?
Yeah, well, here in Texas, I think there's a couple of things. One, Texas is not like Colorado or the other, I think, 45 states that have a non-discrimination statewide ordinance.
Ours are all local,
law,
right?
Or law. Yeah. Right. Yeah, we don't have that. Now, we do have a series of, so it sort of begs the question, Texas probably needs this kind of protection. I don't think, we've talked about this in the past, I don't think you're going to see that anytime soon coming out of the Texas legislature. But we have a series of municipal ordinances. So Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio all have these protections in place. There's nothing in this ruling, I think, that calls into question the legality of those municipal laws.
Yeah.
But I think what it's going to do is it's going to probably look, there's certainly going to be calls by members of the legislature to void those laws, citing this doctrine or their interpretation of what the court says. So you're probably going to see the legislature get in play and try to supersede some local jurisdictions here, local laws. So that's a big change potentially.
Yeah.
But look, the general provision comes into place. We are looking at a state, I think, that you've got this huge division between what local governments want and what the state governments want. And this is just sort of another example of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and Kennedy in his decision suggested that the exception cannot be allowed to swallow the rule, so that the result can't be a long list of individuals or offices that can refuse to perform certain services on the basis of this sort of same-sex relationships. So this is something I think which could and should be noted by Texas. But the Texas model has been that they have pushed these kinds of religious refusal laws. There are something like 10 that I counted when I went online and looked, and a bushel of amendments, of course, too, that evoke religious freedom as a rule. The model is really House Bill 3859, which is a faith-based organizations are allowed to essentially place a child in a school that sort of meets the standard of the individual organization in who's doing the placement. If they don't like the kind of religious aspect of the person being placed with, the child's being placed with, then they can essentially deny that placement. There are lots of others, though, that didn't pass. Some of them went really far, right? House Bill 1923 essentially was a broad kind of law that would have allowed for individuals and businesses and other entities to refuse service to same-sex couples based upon the belief that marriage should be between a man and a woman. This was not something that was just a Freedom Caucus thing, Jay. There were a bunch of people who signed on to this, like the Bonin brothers, Dan Flynn, Dan Huberty, all of whom are, I don't know, somewhat moderate, right, in the context of the legislature. So this will definitely be back on the agenda in the 86th session.
Right. And I also think you're looking again at this collision course between Texas Association of Business and the business community statewide and social conservatives. And it'll be interesting to see kind of where it falls out. You do not have Joe Strauss to stop bills like this going forward. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next legislative session.
Well, there are a bunch of these. Like, there's legislation to expand protections in university clubs, state licensed professionals and county clerks, even homeowners displays. None of them got past the committee level. And part of it is because Speaker Strauss was there basically to kill them. So I think you're exactly right.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to tell you what to expect here in Texas in the next session on these kinds of bills.
So, Jay, the Supreme Court has released this ruling, which has implications for Texas. What do we take away from it?
Yeah, look, I think that you're going to see a whole slew of bills in the next legislative session. I imagine one will pass. The question will be how watered down it is. Again, we've talked about this before. This is a larger question about imposing state sanctions on local entities. We know local governments don't want this. We know the business community doesn't want this. But unfortunately, I think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're wondering what the 8th succession is going to be about, I think the last couple of weeks have clarified that. Number one, it's going to be about guns. And number two, it's going to be about religious freedom. I think we're going to see a couple things from this. Number one, we're going to see the degree to which these newly empowered kind of Republican business interests are able to kind of hold the line against the more movement conservatives on these social policies. And the second is the degree to which local government will push back, right? Like you say, there are a couple of ordinances in some big cities in Texas that have this protection. Will other cities push to have that as well? That's really a big question. And in the meantime, we're going to see a lot of infighting between Republicans.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Gary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
A big thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci. Special kudos to our web team, Giselle Bueno and Matt Prendergast, and our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd the Baker Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.